What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
It is the Pat Kenny Show. It's Anton in for Pat. Supermodel Elle Macpherson's story that she treated her breast cancer with alternative therapies left out crucial information like surgery, and it risked people being misinformed. So we thought we'd look at how damaging claims like these can be for people who are living with cancer and more generally. So I'm joined now, as always, at this time by David Robert Grimes, author and dis and misinformation expert. Morning, David.
Good morning.
So let's get the base of the story correct. Elle Macpherson said effectively that she had waved away things like chemo and had looked after her diet, but neglected to mention the lumpectomy.
Yeah, this is what we call leaving out a very important detail. So technically what she had wouldn't be, by most definitions, considered a cancer. It would have been considered a precancer, something that was not yet invasive, but had the potential to become so. So the standard treatment for that is surgery. And then usually, to make sure there's no recurrence, there is chemotherapy and radiotherapy given. She opted not to take that, which is fair enough. But then she presented this. This happened 7 years ago, by the way. And she's currently flogging a new book and also has her own wellness brand. So she made a big story, got a big splash, claiming that she had like 32 different naturopathic doctors and basically shamans and everything going out to heal her cancer. The fact is, by some definitions, she didn't currently have a cancer. She left out the fact that medical science had removed the actual risky element of it and used this to spin a false narrative. So this is certainly leaving out a very important detail. And unfortunately, this is really, really dangerous. And it's dangerous because people hear this and think, wow, she opted not to get radiotherapy and chemotherapy. They don't realize, of course, that her situation would be very different from theirs. Patients that go for alternative and complementary routes tend to have a much worse outcome from their cancer treatments. They die at roughly twice the rate of people that stick with conventional therapy because they often either reject their conventional therapy or delay it until the point where it's not as effective.
Let me give you the devil's advocate, free speech absolutist view of the world, which would be to say Elle Macpherson is a supermodel and people should have enough wit not to take medical advice from a supermodel, and anybody who gets cancer is going to end up with a GP who is going to refer them to somebody who is an oncologist, and therefore they will have access to proper medical advice. So what harm?
In an ideal world, that's how people would make decisions. But we know that celebrity endorsement and that kind of aspirational lifestyle, I mean, most of us aren't multimillionaires. We couldn't afford 32 people to hang around us and, you know, lay hands on us all the time. It'd be exhausting anyway. But this is something that is aspirational. People are particularly people with poor health literacy, people who get their news primarily from social media, some of the most disadvantaged people in society in particular, they are more adversely affected by this. So in an ideal world, yes, we'd be all getting our medical advice only from medical professionals. However, we have very strong data that stuff we see online, because it's available and it's from figures that we deem aspirational, really affects us. An example from earlier this year, Kim Kardashian, one of the richest women in the world, was promoting a totally unnecessary full body MRI scan for people with the price tag starting at $2,500 up. And again, people really got into this. When Kylie Minogue in 2005 was diagnosed with breast cancer, requests for mammograms in Australia increased by 42%. Unfortunately, it was mainly from younger women who would not have benefited from that mammogram. When Jade Goody got cervical cancer in 2008 and died from it, requests for smears in the UK went up massively. It was called the Jade Goody effect. So celebrity endorsement or celebrity awareness of something actually really percolates into people's consciousness. And unfortunately, so does misinformation.
So with whom does culpability lie? Do you blame Elle Macpherson? Do you blame the publishers who gave her the platform?
Oh, well, I would blame her primarily. And that is because she is not saying this innocently. This is not just her experience that she was asked on a whim. This is something she's now trying to sell for a new book. And this is also the fact that she has her own wellness company. She also would have prior form, because I know we shouldn't judge people about their, you know, personal history. But this was a woman who dated Andrew Wakefield, the disgraced anti-vaccine doctor, long after he had been medically disgraced, and she met him in those circumstances. The alternative health community would have championed Andrew Wakefield for a long time, likely where they interacted. So this is someone who has long had, I would say, a slight contempt for medical science.
And let me come back to Wakefield, because he is an interesting case study in and of himself. What about the defence of honestly held belief? What if Elle Macpherson feels that the homeopathic and holistic treatments that she got contributed to her mental well-being, her physical well-being, provided maybe a placebo effect, though she's unlikely to have said that, and therefore she believes this to be true? Is she still culpable for not second-guessing her own beliefs?
It depends what platform you put it out there. Everyone has the right to their own opinion, but not their own facts. And that is one of the major issues here. Again, this is someone who has a massive platform. So there's a difference in what you'd expect. And also, they're advocating. They're not just saying, well, this worked for me. They are advocating because they are selling that. So this is where the complication comes in. It's not just their personal experience. The other thing is, I would say that this can cause serious damage. The classic example I'll give you is Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs of Apple, one of the most famous, richest men in the world, when he was diagnosed with a cancer that was treatable, it was a rare form of treatable pancreatic cancer, he opted to ignore medical advice and to go to juicing diets and all these natural therapies. By the time he realized that wasn't working, his primary cancer was no longer treatable and he died. Right. But that tragedy plays out.
Did Jobs not have previous, did he not have a surgical intervention at some point early in the case of that cancer? Have I got that wrong?
I don't think so, no. I think he later on, he had to try and make up for it. Now, I'm going off script here because I haven't checked this for a while, but this is kind of almost a case study in the mistakes that can happen when people go down the wrong road. Even if they backtrack, it can be too late. So the thing is, if people are going to make decisions, they have to be informed decisions. So there's a very alluring thing with these natural therapies. That firstly, arsenic and uranium are natural too, but you don't put them on your breakfast cereal, all right? And it's put as a dichotomy with synthetic medicine. In fact, that's an absolutely nonsensical way of looking at the world. But even if you do that, the idea that natural is always good and medicine, synthetic, is always bad is so reductive that it's actually harmful. It also treats them like they're equally valid things. Well, I can take medicine or alternative medicine, but they're not. Patients should have informed consent to make decisions.
I suppose one of the difficulties that people face, though, in this is with the multiplicity of media and the multiplicity of publishers and the attacks on so much media and so many publishers, it is very difficult to decide what sources do you trust and what sources do you not.
Yeah, and the general line, I would say, this goes back to what we talk about all the time with is basic information hygiene. When you hear a claim, particularly if it's a testimonial or an anecdote or something like that, you need to view that with an extreme level of skepticism, even if it's from someone you like or a figure you trust or whatever else. When you read something in the newspapers, you should check, is that true? For example, The Guardian yesterday and The Irish Times repeated did a very good debunking piece on everything Elle Macpherson said. These are reputable media outlets who, and they quoted a lot of experts giving out about this. I was on Australian TV last night talking about this as well. It's a case of that there is good information, but you have to go and seek it out there and go, is this from a newspaper? Is it being questioned? And that's what newspapers should do, and media outlets like this will do. If you go on social media, that level of, you know, fact-checking doesn't always exist. So you need to be far more skeptical about these kind of non-fact-checked sources. And I know people give out about traditional media all the time, but fact-checking, and they are held to some kind of evidentiary standard, whereabouts your social media pages and your popular sites on Instagram are not.
Although, there was always a tradition that a newspaper might libel you on page one and the apology would be buried below the fold on page 14 and nobody would ever see the thing. The equivalent now in the modern era, I assume, with social media is you can do debunk pieces all you like, but if the algorithm doesn't hand them to you in a nice glossy way, you're never going to see
it. You won't get the traction. And this is actually a well-studied phenomena, that if we have wrong information going viral, that the corrective, even if it comes very quickly and is done very authoritatively, doesn't get a fraction of it. And that is because, and I always feel like a broken record repeating this, stuff that outrages us, shocks us, engages us and taps our attention center, we're far more likely to be interested in that. And we don't really care usually to follow it up, because usually correctives, and I mean, I do a lot of them, they're a little bit like, actually, none of that's true. That's not as exciting, usually, as the big mad claim that you heard a few minutes before. But that's why we have to train ourselves to be a little bit more skeptical. If something sounds too good to be true or extremely triggers some kind of your danger sense, you should listen to that and go, I'm going to hold back on making a judgment on this until I've checked this through a reputable source. If you read about, for example, cancer treatments from Elle Macpherson, you should probably talk to your doctor, because they're eminently more qualified to make a judgment on that than a testimonial from a superstar.
Although more and more now, what we are seeing is the counter fact check, where somebody says something that is spurious and specious. There is a fact check, and then there is a cast of thousands who line up to say, oh, well, hang on a minute, and to reiterate the original daft notion.
Yeah. And there's a lot, so this is, you know, all in sound, in the sound and fury signifying nothing to butcher the bard. And that's a lot of social media stuff. But then again, this is where we have to train our own media literacy, our own information literacy quite a lot more. That we should, and this sounds cynical, and I'm not advocating cynicism, I'm saying skepticism. We should treat claims online, particularly online, with a huge degree of skepticism and almost entertain it so it doesn't affect us. So we're not infected by it. If we're infected by disinformation, we infect other people with it, and it can cause serious harm. If you look at information with that kind of cautious set of gloves, like your protective equipment back in the pandemic, and you go, yeah, okay, I'm going to leave that aside and not have an opinion on that until I've checked it independently, we would do a lot more good. Unfortunately, social media rewards immediacy. Now, now, now. Say the thing that pops into your brain, even if it's a terrible idea. So we have two competing forces there. We have one, which is the immediacy that social media demands we share things, and the reality that we need to reflect before we react. And that's hard to do.
The other thing that is hard to do is to live your life constantly questioning everything that lands in front of you, because there comes a certain point at which you are crippled by doing that.
Well, not entirely, because I mean, as a philosophy of skepticism, it's not necessarily like that. You verify source and you have source validation, right? So you know, on this count, and you also have what we call lateral reading or independent reading. If I'm reading something in an article, a new thing that I've not come across before, I might open Wikipedia in the background and just go, I don't know that term.
Famed for its accuracy.
Well, actually, it is. I always say this to my students. Wikipedia is actually highly accurate. And if you check it up, if you want, as an exercise, I don't recommend you do this, put something false in Wikipedia, see how long it lasts. It will be removed rapidly, because they have an army of volunteers who do that fact-checking. But I always say, follow the references.
The last time I checked Wikipedia about me, it made 12 assertions, of which 10 were completely false.
I was drunk when I wrote that. But the thing is, it's gotten a lot, back in the day, I mean, it used to be, but it's gotten to the point where it's incredibly organised, and so it still has inaccuracies, but it corrects them very, very quickly, whereas printed encyclopedias don't. So just for, as compared to printed encyclopedias, it's a much quicker system. But you can also do other lateral reading. You can check news sites and things like that. So when I'm reading an article on something I don't know, that's often what I'll do. I'll open something in a tab to go, I don't know what that term means. I don't know if that's the correct definition of it. It slows you down initially, but after a while it gets really quick and you do it automatically, and you already have learnt it before. So it's just recall rather than having to do
so
it.
So if we take this as a case in point, you read the Elle Macpherson assertion, and what you do is you say, well, what's the cancer type she says she had? Okay, Wikipedia that cancer type and find its survivability. Look to see, do I have a reputable source analysing her claim? And between the three or four different things, make a decision.
Exactly. So for example, and sometimes that's done for us by media outlets. For example, again, I bring up the Guardian Irish Times piece yesterday. They had already done that. They'd gone to all these different experts and said, what kind of cancer was this, or pre-cancer was this? Can we get that? And they had it all there, nice and neatly laid out. But if you wanted to check it independently, you could also check it independently. And once you've found source validity, you go, okay, that's a reliable source. You can usually rely on that, but you have to keep the skepticism turned on, because they can get things wrong.
Now, you mentioned Andrew Wakefield. Andrew Wakefield, of course, famously erroneously, wrongly, and has been debunked 9 miles long, linked autism with the MMR vaccination. And that caused a significant drop off in people getting MMR at the time. What's interesting about that is we have a cyclical response to vaccines. We had a similar thing with the whooping cough vaccine, where there was a significant drop off in people getting it in the late 70s and early 80s.
And the pertussis vaccine as well in the 70s as well.
Measles as we stand now.
HPV COVID vaccine 2015 to 2017 in Ireland. Yeah.
Why do we not learn the lessons of our own history when it comes to misinformation?
Partly because there's a huge generational separation between that. I wasn't born in the 1970s, for example, so I wouldn't, I mean, I've read about it academically, but that's gone. People who were affected by the HPV vaccine disinformation in 2015 may not have been alive or remembered the 1998 Wakefield thing, because there's enough of a separation that it falls out of our cultural consciousness. I'd also add, by the way, to Wakefield, the term deliberate, because he was exposed as doing this deliberately for profit, as well. He was getting backhanders to develop his own single-shot vaccines, and he had received over £465,000. This is Brian Deer, the investigative journalist, exposed all this, which is why he lost his license. So he was a charlatan as well as just being wrong. People can be wrong, but he was a charlatan. But the reason we forget this, again, is scary claims grab our attention a lot more. The recent example in Ireland, and I was quite actively involved in this, was the HPV vaccine campaign. The parents that weren't vaccinating their children, they weren't dyed-in-the-wool anti-vaxxers, but they were hearing really scary things. Now, if they'd known the history, they would have known this was a regurgitation of scary claims that were made about vaccines since the late 1700s. But they were forgiven for not knowing that. They heard something frightening, and they're, same with the MMR vaccine, the panic over that in the late 1990s. People get scared and they get hesitant. So you can approach that if you have conversations with people and you say, look, the evidence is actually this, and this is much more beneficial than the converse.
What then about our incapacity to focus on the things that actually matter? Because if you look currently, I mean, Elle Macpherson is a case in point.
Massive. Why are we talking about Elle Macpherson?
Well, exactly. Who ultimately cares about Elle Macpherson's view on cancer treatments? It is not significant in the big scheme of things. But if you look at the political dialogue, particularly across the US, most of it is captivated by stuff which materially will not impact those who are making the decision about who are present. Whereas the things that do matter, like, for instance, healthcare, social security, all those matters are secondary. Why are we bad at sifting through mis- and disinformation to find that which actually matters?
Because there's an immediacy effect. To have an opinion on Elle Macpherson, you don't have to be particularly informed, right? You just have to grab on, I like what she says or I don't like what she says. To have an opinion on policy or climate change or anything else requires you to get informed for the most part. So there is, and also we are really attracted to celebrity news. We all pretend we're not. Even I'd be like, I'm not interested in that. And yet somehow you'll find yourself browsing some random trivia site on that kind of stuff because we have a human compulsion to be social creatures. So this is low hanging fruit for our attention. This is why we'll go really bent out of shape about stories that don't have that much impact. It's because we can all have an opinion on them. But the problem with rapidly formed opinions is they are usually garbage. They are not worth the time that you even put into investing in it, and you didn't put that much time into thinking about it. But they engage conversations. For example, we know today that, you know, on the scheme of things, a bike shed in the Dáil probably, you know, isn't that huge a deal.
Yeah, but 300 grand.
Exactly. But that's going to grab our attention because we can all have an instant opinion on it, right? And obviously it's something that needs to be looked at as a culture, whatever else. But more complicated, nuanced events, we don't usually want to put the workload in. So there's a level of that it's easier to have an opinion on things that are easier to form opinions on.
Finally, and as a subfunction of that, why are we bad at accepting things we don't know? There is an internal compunction and a social compunction that we must all have a position on things in many instances where we have no expertise at all about the thing.
Oh, absolutely. My default position, I will always tell people when I'm asked about something outside of my area, is I don't have an opinion on that because I don't know enough about it. But people think, and this is partly the fact that we are social animals, and it's partly the fact we identify. We want to mark as a part of a tribe, right? We want to signal in some ways that I'm, you know, if someone asks you an opinion about a current human humanitarian crisis, you want to come down on the right side and signal to other people like you that I'm like you. And so you might simplify that situation, when often the correct response is, I actually don't know enough about that yet to have an opinion. But again, that looks like cowardice to some people. It's not. It's actually, it's intellectually more honest and it has more humility. But we like to form instant opinions because we're social animals and we're looking for our tribe all the time. And social media, by the way, has again exacerbated that into mindless tribalism.
David, as ever, thank you. David Robert Grimes, author and disinformation and misinformation expert there. Now, we'll give you a shout at the cash machine.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.